We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
The U.S. issued some of its strongest statements yet Friday, saying the Syrian government was behind an apparent chemical attack.
And Russia's foreign minister says Moscow has solid evidence that the alleged chemical attack in Douma in Syria was staged.
Now at 10, breaking news. The United States, France and Britain unleash airstrikes on Syria.
Doubts are continuing to grow over claims of a chemical weapons attack in the Syrian city of Douma earlier this month. A number of Western journalists who travel to the city say they are struggling to find eyewitnesses to confirm the reports.
What was your reaction when you first heard of the Anglo-American-French missile attacks on Syria?
It's built on a series of, I would call them lies, fabrications.
The great problem of Syria is that it's being affected by proxy wars. And the more nations such as Britain and the United States and others can remove themselves in those proxy wars, the more likely it is that the Syrian people can decide their own future.
The conflict in Syria is taking place on two fronts. The first and most important front is on the ground, where for the past 7 years, the country's armed forces, in conjunction with its allies, have been weathering a storm in the shape of a foreign-financed and supported Salafist insurgency, one coterminous with a latter-day Khmer Rouge in its objective of implementing a sectarian and fundamentalist year zero on a secular, non-sectarian, multi-religious and multicultural society. In practice, this process would involve the annihilation and extirpation of minority communities that are able to trace their presence in this part of the world back over millennia. The other front in this struggle is the news narrative. Some call it propaganda, others infowars. Whatever your preferred appellation may be, this secondary front has taken on an importance never seen in any conflict hitherto. Why, you may ask? Well, self-evidently, the stakes when it comes to the outcome of the conflict in Syria transcend the country itself, indeed transcend the region, to take on a global geopolitical importance that we have covered on this show numerous times. Suffice to say that we are living through a period of interregnum, one that lies between the old hegemonic unipolar world led and dominated by Washington and an anti-hegemonic multipolar alternative demanded by the emergence of Russia and China as geopolitical counterweights to Washington and its Western allies. The point is that the regional and geopolitical stakes attached to the outcome of events in Syria are reflected in the battle that has raged over the right to shape the narrative. And as part of this battle, those Western voices that have dared dissent from the narrative presented and proffered by their own governments and media have experienced the kind of calumniation you might associate with, well, the devil himself, depicted as a sadist, Kremlin stooges, cranks, conspiracy theorists, and even traitors. A prime example of the egregious and dishonest character assassination to which I refer involves veteran foreign and Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk. The day before Robert Fisk filed his report from on the ground in Douma, site of the alleged chemical weapons attack carried out by Syrian government forces, he was widely considered one of the finest foreign correspondents, not just of this generation, but of any generation, boasting a slew of awards and carrying a reputation of international repute. No matter, the day after Robert Fisk filed his report in The Independent on Douma, casting doubt on the official narrative, all of a sudden he became a crank, a fool, a propagandist, and so on. Ultimately, Winston Churchill said it best, in wartime, truth is so precious, she must always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. And the truth, when it comes to the conflict in Syria, raging now over 7 long years, is that the Western mainstream media, with few, all too few exceptions, is not fit for purpose. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Someone who is a dissenting voice when it comes to the mainstream narrative of the conflict in Syria, and whose views cannot be so easily dismissed, is the Baroness Caroline Cox, crossbench member of Britain's House of Lords. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Now, you produced a report on your visit. You visited the country recently as part of a delegation. I wonder if, first of all, you could enlighten the listeners as to the reasons for the visit, the purpose of the visit, and how it came about.
Thank you very much. The reason for visit is he called a pastoral visit. It consisted of mainly clergy of various denominations, Christian clergy, but also a couple of members of the House of Lords, and then other people, including journalists and academics. And that's who we consisted of. The reason we went was to show, I think, our solidarity with the people of Syria in very difficult times, and also to hear their voice. One of my most important commitments is to let the voice of the people of Syria be heard, let the people of Syria decide their own future, and let's stop imposing Western alternatives on them. And so that was my agenda for going, to listen to the people of Syria. We actually called our report Voices from Syria, and we met a very wide range of people in Damascus, in Homs, in Aleppo, in Sirnaya, in Maloula. We met faith leaders, and we went under the invitation of His Holiness, the Patriarch of the Syrian Orthodox Church.
Now, I believe that you visited the country in 2017 also. What differences did you find within that year, going back in 2018? And if you could just outline some of the key differences you found between 2017 and 2018, between your two visits that you've had to the country.
Would just let you to expand on that. I went in 2016 as well. So if I can just add that visit into the answer to your question, because in 2016, we were up in Aleppo, when Eastern Aleppo was still in the hands of the jihadists, and they were firing missiles of all kinds onto Western Aleppo, where we were. And it was a far higher tension. It was active conflict going on at that time. Then when we went in 2017, visit to which you refer, it's very poignant, really, because there was much greater hope then. The Syrian army, helped obviously by the Russian army, had helped to get rid of ISIS and all the other related Islamist jihadist groups from most of Syria, I think basically probably for 90% of Syria. And we had some very positive meetings and reports that they really felt that peace could be in sight and they could begin to rebuild their future. And so that was a much more positive and hopeful visit. I mean, obviously, huge suffering, enormous continuing suffering. I'm not belittling that in any way. You only have to see the miles and miles of utterly destroyed buildings, factories, hospitals, schools, and so on, and the personal suffering of people who have loved ones who've been taken as hostages and kidnapped victims. And so the suffering was real, but there was a hope there might be a way forward. And then this visit, of course, coincided with the missile attack by the United States, United Kingdom, and France. And that put a very different atmosphere on things, that people were extremely disturbed, angry, and worried.
Now, based on your experience of visiting the country three times, 2016, 2017, and 2018, and speaking to the people and travelling the country, what do you discern when it comes to the Western mainstream narrative of the conflict? Is it anywhere close to the reality that you find on the ground?
There's a huge discrepancy. I think that some of the main findings that come from our discussions with people, and so we met a wide range of people, say faith leaders, politicians, members of the opposition, politicians, academics, musicians, intelligentsia, local people, and everywhere we went. I think there were two main themes. One was they are very concerned about what is at least the British government's commitment, and repeated again and again in Parliament, to regime change. The last thing anyone we met in Syria wanted was forced regime change, because there is no moderate armed opposition left, and so forced regime change would just create another chaotic, disastrous situation like Libya and Iraq. So there is a real concern about that part of the Western nations' agenda, and particularly the British agenda. And the other thing, of course, when we were there, was real anger over the missile strikes. We were there just within hours of their being inflicted on the people of Syria, and the main criticisms were, first, that they were illegal, that there was no mandate for them, there's no UN mandate for them, and the other justification for striking another country is if it's an immediate threat to your own country. And of course, Syria is not an immediate military threat to the United States, to the United Kingdom, or to France. So they were illegal, but also there was great concern that they took place before the chemical weapons experts were able to visit the region, so before there was an independent report or independent verification of the fact that they had taken place and that they had been, if they had, been committed by President Assad and the Syrian army. There was no evidence for that. And then the third concern is that if it might have been the case there was a chemical weapons incident, it might have been undertaken deliberately by the jihadists. They have access to these materials, and that the immediate response from President Trump, supported by Britain and France, would be, you know, incitement to them, invitation to them to do such a thing again, perhaps in forthcoming conflicts in Idlib, which would bring in an even more ferocious attack from maybe Britain, America, and France. And that just prolongs the war, prolongs the suffering of the people of Syria, and delays the military extermination, if you like, or evacuation of the jihadists from Syria. So a lot of concerns.
Now, we're coming up to the break, Caroline, but just quickly, I mentioned in my introduction the plight of Syria's myriad minority communities, communities that can trace their presence in the country, in that part of the world, back a millennia. Am I overstating the fact, the danger that they would be in if the Assad government was to be overthrown by these various Salafi jihadi groups?
I think absolutely it would be a very, very real danger. There are numerous reports of the treatment of the faith minority groups by the Islamist jihadists, ISIS, and other groups. Brutal, brutal treatment, executions, torture. These things, on the whole, do not receive comparable coverage in Western media. And another group that are really worried about the possibility of forced regime change are women. I mean, President Assad has a great respect for the rights of women and the rights of faith minorities. And whereas I don't condone everything he's done in the past, the people really do, and I respect his commitment in these areas. And of course, women would be very afraid of the alternative if the ISIS were to return and to continue its atrocities, and similarly, the different faith minorities, but also many Muslims as well. I mean, I met a Muslim lady in Latakia, and she'd seen her husband and her son beheaded in front of her. And she summed it up. She said, war is terrible. People die of shelling from both sides, but one you die from shelling, the other die, you die from shelling and beheadings, and we don't want the beheadings.
You're listening to Baroness Caroline Cox. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of the Baroness Caroline Cox, crossbench member of the British House of Lords, and we are discussing her experiences after visiting Syria just before the Western missile strike over allegations, I stress the word, of a chemical weapons attack launched by Syrian government forces against that part of Eastern Ghouta, just at the point, by the way, at which they were about to take control of the entire district of Eastern Ghouta. I just ask you to bear that in mind. Now, Caroline, you produced a report, and I have to say, I have read many, countless analyses, articles, and books on the conflict in Syria, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the show. This report is by far the most compelling and insightful and profound analyses and documentary of what's going on Syria on the ground. What favours this report is because the emphasis is placed on Syrian voices throughout, from all walks of life, from all background. Now, I really hope that this report somehow, some way, will be made available for public consumption on a website that can be downloaded, because people really need to read this, because it does penetrate the miasma of propaganda and obfuscation that has been allowed to descend on the conflict by the Western mainstream media and their governments like a fog. But in the summary that you produce, I'd like to read something under the heading media coverage, because I think it gets to the heart of the matter. And it reads, and I quote, "Many asked why the horrendous and well-documented atrocities perpetrated by various jihadist fighting groups and the appalling scale of those atrocities are given very little publicity by Western media compared to the focus on actions carried out by the Assad government and armed forces." And in the report, there's also eyewitness testimony as to the details of some of these atrocities. And people really need to hear this stuff. You spoke to a gentleman, I'm not going to give any names because I think these people could still be in danger, but he's a resident of Damascus. And he says, and I quote, "I support Assad, as without him, the country would fall apart. In one village in 2014, there was a purge and al-Nusra women's lips were chopped off for wearing lipstick and many women were executed. One man had his fingertips chopped off for smoking. There was brutal treatment of Christians, including crucifixion and the murder of babies." My word, Caroline, what on earth are our government doing siding with these obi-plight militants? Because effectively, that's what we have been doing. Effectively, whether directly or not, we have been siding with these militants in trying to undermine and overthrow a secular government. Regardless of what you might think of Bashar al-Assad, Carolyn, I wonder if you'd agree, this is not about saving his government. It's about saving Syria itself, isn't it?
Absolutely right. You put it completely as I believe it and have expressed it. One of the great tragedies, I think, of the way in which it's been presented in Western media has been the constant criticism of President Assad and his government and what's happened in the past, and the constant negation of what everyone whom we met in Syria passionately believe, and that is that the priority must be to get rid of ISIS and all the other related Islamist groups. And that's where I think, you know, the Russian army has been extremely good in helping with that priority. And where the people of Syria are terrified that, you know, the war will be prolonged, that it's proxy wars, and that the kind of atrocities, which so many of them have really suffered at the hands of the jihadists, will be perpetuated. And for me, that is very, very serious.
Now, you sit at the heart of the establishment, Caroline. As I say, you're a crossbench member of the British House of Lords. You couldn't be any more deep within the establishment in that capacity. You speak to your colleagues. I mean, do they really believe what they're saying, those who gainsay the narrative that you put forward based on your experiences, that Syrians support their government and that the only hope for Syria at this point is the survival of the Assad government? Do they really believe that it is actually right that Assad go, that he is this tyrant and despot who is ruling over his country against popular will? Do they really believe this stuff? Or do you think that they are ideologically driven and they are, in that sense, abstracting the truth from their worldview as a consequence?
Many have actually agreed with me and do agree with me in questions and debates. And three former British ambassadors to Syria, two members of the House of Lords and one who's not, wrote a letter some time ago to the famous British newspaper, The Times, in which they criticised British foreign policy of imposed regime change, indicating that it would just create another chaotic situation like Iraq and Libya. And they also emphasised the point I always emphasise, please let the people of Syria decide their own future. So there is concern amongst people who do understand the situation and they do express that concern. But also just to go back to a point you made earlier on about the British government position, I asked for several questions for written answers, trying to find out what support the British taxpayer has been given through the British government to groups allied to the jihadist groups. And I've got very interesting answers. Millions of pounds worth of taxpayers' money has gone to groups who are, in one way or another, supportive of or working alongside jihadist groups. And there was actually a panorama program on the BBC which highlighted just one small, tiny aspect of that serious...
Sorry, can I just interject? You've actually... this is actually documented.
Yes,
that there is a trail of money that's being...
Absolutely.
My word.
People are very angry about that. And the Panorama programme had it's something like this, it may not be exactly right, but British taxpayers supporting jihadist groups. You know, so this is deeply, deeply disturbing. One's trying to highlight these situations because, in my view, they are entirely unacceptable. And as I say, they prolong the suffering of the people of Syria. And I think the British government needs to be called to account, both for that aspect of supporting groups which are not in any way helping the ending of the war, put it like that, and also called to account, I believe, for using those missile attacks.
Worse than that, Caroline, these are groups that adhere to the same ideology responsible for the atrocity of 9/11, for the Madrid bomb in 2004, for 7/7 in London, for the raft of terrorist attacks that have taken place all over the West in recent years. In London last year, we had three, I believe. I mean, this is monstrous.
Well, I think many British people feel that when one is able to tell them that. And as if some of my colleagues do actually share this and have spoken about their concerns in the House of Lords. But we still have a very, very committed foreign policy at the moment, which is committed to regime change. And my answer to that is, please, you know, let us stop fighting proxy wars and let the people of Syria choose their own future. They're a deeply, deeply civilized people, and they have centuries of pluralism, of cultural achievements, of
tolerance,
diversity,
yeah.
Wonderful people.
What do you think is driving the regime change narrative? What is the objective? What are the wider strategic objectives behind this, Caroline? What, in your opinion?
Well, I can only... I like to be the voice of other people, but there were two very good articles, one by Robert Fisk, who went in and challenged the authenticity of the use of chemical weapons in Douma or in Ghouta, which triggered the attacks. Another very good article by Jonathan Cook, in which he suggests that one of the reasons why our foreign policy is as it is because of pressure from neighboring governments such as Saudi Arabia, who may not want peace in Syria.
Now, this alliance with the Saudis really is, it is the disgrace on many levels, Britain's alliance with the Saudis, isn't it? It benefits no one except arms companies. It imperils our security, I would contend. This is our
and
government.
It's on the record that they have given millions to the jihadists as well. So it's a very, very disturbing situation. But the other thing, just very briefly, it gets me very angry, is that what I perceive and claim a double standard in British foreign policy, that I do a lot of work in Sudan. There's a president there who's been indicted by the International Criminal Court. He's been responsible for at least 3 million dead, 5 million displaced, thousands taken into slavery, genocidal policies in Darfur, chemical weapons in Darfur. And the British government has said it's now stopped using sticks and is using carrots, and that we are promoting trade with Sudan. Now, the double standards there, we won't even have an embassy in Damascus, and promoting trade with Sudan with a president indicted by the International Criminal Court. So I get very angry.
You're right to be angry, not to mention the suffering of the Yemeni people.
Absolutely.
With our support, with British arms being used and British troops, as it was revealed in a Daily Mail article towards the end of last year, who were in Saudi Arabia in a training capacity. I believe it was called Operation Crossways, training Saudi forces to go and fight in Yemen. It really is akin.
We share the same passion and the same concerns.
Indeed we do. Now, returning to Syria, Caroline, and this report, the one topic that comes up time and time again, and is little covered, for obvious reasons, because there's so many elements to this conflict, and that's the issue of the sanctions that have been imposed on Syria and the suffering that it's causing the Syrian people, or compounding the suffering of the Syrian people.
Absolutely.
Through the course of this conflict. Perhaps you could explain the consequences of the sanctions and how grievous they are when it comes to the ability of the Syrians to resist and to recover from some of the huge damage that they've incurred throughout the course of the conflict.
Yes, we have real creed occur from organisations like the Doctors' Society in Aleppo and others for the West to lift the sanctions because they're causing suffering for the people. And so in terms of medical supplies, I mean, some may be allowed through, but there's tremendous bureaucratic hurdles to be overcome, and people die because they can't get the medicines that they need. And on the food side, there are great food shortages. And one man from Malula put it very well. He said, we want to go back to our homes, but in Syria is a real danger that you may get killed by ISIS if they come back. Secondly, if you do, you may get beheaded. But secondly, you may die of starvation because there is just not food, and that is exacerbated by sanctions. My tiny little not-for-profit NGO, Heart, we are trying to arrange a program in Malula to help women to preserve fruits and vegetables and so on, A, for food, and B, to sell, to get a little bit of economy going. But there is desperate need, and the needs are exacerbated horrendously by the sanctions.
Now, what is the treatment you've received in the hands of the mainstream media in the UK, BBC, Sky News and so on, over your visit to Syria and the stories that you're telling from the country? How has that gone down within the mainstream?
Well, the mainstream has been very hostile, a very aggressive article in the Times, and totally taking any attention away from the key issues, you know, for which we are most passionately concerned. A very aggressive interview on the BBC Today programme, which I kept getting interrupted again and again and again, and the allegations about the hangings that have been authorised by the Grand Mufti, I think were reported in the Amnesty International report, has been robustly criticised, and the criticisms have never been rebutted. But that was a very, very aggressive BBC radio programme, on the famous Today programme, so very hostile, and it seems to me, and this is my personal perception, an attempt to discredit me so that anything I say will also be discredited.
Based on what you know, given your experience on the ground in Syria, Carling, what is the emotion towards your country? Is it to fill you in any way with shame or embarrassment or anger or a combination of all three? I know it does myself.
Well, myself, I mean, it makes me feel passionately sad. As civilized people, they've suffered too much for too long, and I think British foreign policy is prolonging that suffering and preventing a peaceful resolution and a way forward. The way forward should be get rid of ISIS and all the other groups and then develop, you know, maybe a new constitution, independent elections, and start rebuilding Syria. So I feel deeply saddened and deeply angry. I have a lingering flame of hope because there is still a great spirit amongst the people of Syria. When the missiles were falling, they did not go underground. They stayed up above ground defiantly. And they are rebuilding. You go to Homs, you go to Aleppo, you see rebuilding in the middle of the ruins. We were hosted in Aleppo by the Armenian Evangelical Church. They've rebuilt 6 schools, including 4 in Aleppo, and wonderful interfaith relations. I mean, they're a Christian church. They rebuilt the girls' school in Aleppo, and there are 400 Muslim schoolgirls there. I mean, there is a real interfaith affection, respect, support for each other. And if only the West would let them get on with rebuilding Syria, I think they could do it very quickly. But it would certainly be helped if sanctions could be lifted and the threat of imposed regime change removed.
Well, all I can say is if a secular, multi-religious, multicultural, non-sectarian society is not worth fighting for, then nothing is. You've been listening to Baroness Caroline Cox. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.